Hey guys, welcome back to Group Therapy. I'm one of your hosts, licensed clinical social worker, Kristen Gingrich.
And I'm licensed psychologist, Dr. Kristen Casey.
I'm licensed psychologist, Dr. Jessica Rabin.
I happen to be licensed psychologist, Dr. J.
Just happens to be.
And I know, just happens today. We don't know what tomorrow might be, but today he is Dr. J. This week, we are all talking about the different therapy modalities that are different from maybe one-on-one therapy, like group therapy, IOP, wilderness therapy. Like, what is even wilderness therapy? We're going to dive into it this week. So settle in, take a seat, and welcome to group therapy. So I'm actually kind of excited about this topic because I don't even know what different modalities you guys have done outside of one-on-one in that. So let's start that off. Like, has anybody done different modalities outside of just one-on-one individual?
Yes.
I mean, group therapy. If we're thinking of like higher levels of care, like I did work acute psychiatric inpatient, which is a combination of like individual group therapies, things like that. A fun fact about me, which I don't know if any of you all know, I used to work for an assessment company that was contracted with wilderness therapy camps. So even though I did not like do the therapy aspect, I did psychological assessments there. So I got exposure to that. What about the rest of y'all?
I've mostly done individual. I maybe had like two couples cases during internship. Did like a little bit of family therapy when I worked inpatient at an eating disorder clinic in the middle of nowhere in Arizona. Literally, it was like not traumatizing, but it was so in the middle of nowhere that I was like, this is like remote. This is desolate. You know, it was really beautiful. But a lot of the patients who were there, they would say like, where are we? Are we in the middle of nowhere? And I'm like, it feels like it, you know? So it was a really interesting experience. We did wilderness therapy there, actually, now that I think about it. Equine therapy, actually, not wilderness therapy. And then, yeah, just individual, really, an inpatient. I mean, I've had a lot of inpatient crisis experience, but never really done couples. I work with people on their relationships, but yeah, that's about it. What about y'all?
Yeah, I've done a lot of group. I was the group coordinator at Florida Atlantic University, all kinds of groups, you know, psychoed, support, interpersonal process. Like, I've done pretty much every style group that is. I love groups so much. Love the dynamic. A good amount of couples, gotten a lot of good couples trainings after graduating because I didn't get hardly any while I was in school. Worked with a lot of couples over the years and enjoyed that a lot. But otherwise, I did IOP for a year. It was like, we pick kids up in this little white van. It sounds bad. I'm going to pivot from that statement quick. But we'd visit them at school, make sure they're stay on task, and then pick them up in the white van after school and do like a day treatment thing, and then drop them off after a few hours after school. We would like do homework with them, do some therapy. It was a blast. Did that for a year. But otherwise, not the other levels. Never did inpatient. Yeah, crisis, not acute. No, not really. A few situations here and there at the university level. So I'm excited for this discussion and hear from y'all. But what about you, KBI?
Yeah, the jokes I want to make, but I will refrain.
Yeah, sometimes on a podcast, you start describing something, you realize it didn't sound good, but it doesn't
work in your favor in this.
No.
You could have just said, pick them up in a van. Like, it didn't need to be white.
You didn't even have to say that. You know what I mean?
Like pick them up from school.
But it paints a picture.
It does paint a picture.
I feel like it's not a creepy picture.
I'm scared.
Yeah. Sometimes you don't know it's creepy until it comes out your mouth.
You're right.
You
know? You're right. Mm-hmm. We know you had good intentions.
Yeah.
They were there. I definitely, the one-on-one is definitely my focus. I've worked with a couple couples. It was not my favorite. I've done some group work, but not a ton. A lot of my group work would probably be in like residential. I have a lot of residential experience in doing like kind of like that group milieu therapy in a way. Crisis, like even crisis unit. I worked on a crisis unit, but definitely a lot of that residential experiences. And even within that, a lot of that is the one-on-one. But I think that even one-on-one in residential is very different than one-on-one in an outpatient setting, because I'd be doing one-on-one with clients who I'd see in a half hour to have lunch with. At like, we would all be sitting down having a snack or whatever. So it was very, that dynamic is very different.
Yeah, I think the setting kind of dictates how different it could be, you know, because like, as I'm hearing you talk about group in an inpatient setting, it's certainly different than group on the outpatient setting, you know, mm-hmm. like when you run a group and stuff. And I'm curious too, like I never really got couples training in grad school. Now that I'm hearing your experiences, like what about KBI? Did you get any couples experience in group or in a grad school?
No.
Yeah. I wonder. No. That's so interesting. Cause I feel like I would be interested in doing couples. I just literally don't have the training. Like I just don't.
We had like family, like you had family mm-hmm. training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like you could take a little bit of that and pull it over, but it wasn't anything that would make me feel confident working with couples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had some family training as well, which I realized I didn't say. I work with families, like even if my primary intervention is individual, I do a lot of family work.
Because you work with youth.
Because I work with, yeah.
If you work with youth, you're going to work with yeah. the family. Yeah.
True. So we do yeah. family therapy, but it's usually, I always tell, like for me at least, family therapy is not my primary modality.
Correct.
So I'll do individual right. and then we'll pull in family. Okay. I do wonder, because none of us are LMFTs here. I wonder if mm-hmm. marriage and family therapists get more specific couples training.
Oh, yeah, they do.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, mm-hmm.
Every person I met out there has had significant, and I'm sure there's program differences, but overall, my understanding is they get a lot.
Yeah. Like, I don't even know if a couples course was offered. It might have been because I obviously knew I wanted to work with kids and teens, so I wouldn't have taken it, but I don't think a couples therapy course was even offered in my grad program.
A lot of people who have done the Gottman training, like Justin mm-hmm. was saying, like, I don't mm-hmm. know if you did the Gottman training, Justin. I'm just saying, like, after grad school, I noticed right. a lot of people have gotten more training. So maybe that's kind of where you specialize is after grad school if you don't have that experience, but interesting.
So I know, KBI, you just asked about like our experiences. Does anybody have like a favorite modality outside of individual that maybe we could start just kind of talking about? Just kick off the conversation.
I just like the dynamics of family.
See,
as much as I hated working with families when I did it, the dynamics of family therapy and trying to manage that.
It's like an art and a science and a lot of distress tolerance, in my opinion, personally.
That is it summed up in a goddamn nutshell.
Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. It's really, I think it could be really healing for people. I personally have never been able to do for counter transference reasons. I just can't do it. But I could see it being so helpful for families, especially if you have like a lot going on with multiple family members. But what is it like actually managing that in real time? Because when you have like a family therapy situation, they're all your client, right? Like the family is the client. Is that how it works?
Right.
Yeah.
It's like herding cats. It really is, because you'd think you got three of them over here. You got them all on the same page. And then one is just, it snuck away. And you're like, how did we get over here?
Mm-hmm.
Or it can be really hard, because all it takes is one person's dynamic, one person's opinion, mm-hmm. one person's thought process to derail an entire session in a way. Or change mm-hmm. it up very quickly, or change the direction of progress
mm-hmm.
Because of that dynamic and the enmeshment that is family in mm-hmm. so many ways.
Yeah, I think family is like the hardest group I've ever run. Like,
I'm sure.
I love group therapy. I have the yeah. personality for group therapy as an extrovert. I love the energy of it, which is why I like the energy of couples in family.
Mm-hmm.
You get more energy if there's more than one person. I know that's mm-hmm. going to blow some people's minds, but obviously. But I really like that. I like noticing the channels of communication. And the things I tell young therapists who are like thinking about all these different modalities of where they might want to work, I think when you work in a group or with couples or in a family, the spotlight isn't always on you mm-hmm. as a therapist. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Like, you can help pivot the conversation and highlight certain communication patterns. But when there's more people, it's like you can observe and sort of, but in one-on-one, my clients stare right at me. I stare right at them, and mm-hmm. it's me and them. And so I feel it's interesting. I'm making it about me, but my personality, I feel really energized in a group. And I like that mm-hmm. I can see the dynamics happening between people and facilitate a conversation that isn't all on me. And I also love in group, which is what I always try to pitch people on. you get real-time feedback from your peers, not some crotchety old mental health professional who might have nothing to do with your life, your dynamic, your difficulty. And mm-hmm. it's something that individual therapy cannot offer you.
Yeah.
But you, mm-hmm. in a group amongst your peers, maybe it's under the same difficulty, maybe you're in like an LGBTQ group or something like that. It is real-time connection that, again, with your peers, with people that you can form connection with, depending on the type of group it is, that it is, it's a different level of connection that you're just not going to get in an ethical individual therapy session.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many benefits to group, I think. And when I was running groups at the VA, I ran a transgender support group. And as a facilitator who's not trans, I felt like, oh gosh, like, what do I have to offer? But the beautiful thing about group is what you're just describing. All the group members are, they're not facilitators, but they kind of are, you know what I mean? For each person. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people might leave group feeling a little more drained than individual therapy, depending on who you are, if you're an introvert or something like that. True. But I think the benefits far outweigh the risks if you're looking for peer support, if you're looking for other people's experiences, if you're feeling really alone in your experience and you really want to know, like, do other people feel this way? Or can I get more than one opinion on what I'm dealing with? You know, I think it's a beautiful thing to be able to connect together. And you don't always learn, like you said, from that one facilitator. I think it's just so many benefits. And I think of all the ways in which group could be not so helpful as well. And I think it's important to talk about. Any thoughts, any ideas for maybe people who are considering group and they're like, I don't know if it'd be right for me. Any thoughts?
I know a lot of my teen clients, when we're talking about maybe getting involved in a group, a lot of them with social anxiety need to definitely build up skills before going, because if they do, they feel like I'm just going to sit there and they feel more uncomfortable and awkward. Yeah. I also know, depending on the type of group, like if it's a specific like DBT skills group, for example, usually there's not as many issues. But like I've had some of my clients go to just like a teen like emotion regulation group, and it's like very broad. And sometimes there's a group member that, kind of like KBI was saying with family therapy, like derails the entire group. And depending on, you know, the facilitator, their skill level, things like that, if it's not well managed, it can definitely cause interpersonal issues. It can leave a bad taste in someone's mouth of like, well, if this is what group therapy is, I've heard stories or experience just as a facilitator, like people overtaking the conversation, like, I don't want to say oversharing, but like definitely, yeah, spending the majority of the time talking about themselves, not giving others opportunities. And depending on the group, you know, interpersonal dynamics, like we're not going to get along with everyone, and group is not necessarily about getting along with everyone. But sometimes if the vetting process, because I know different groups have different criteria, like some will like screen and vet participants to make sure that the group meshes well. When I did group on acute inpatient, it's whatever the milieu is. So if you have two kids that hate each other and like don't get along, they're in the same group. So I think the interpersonal dynamics can be hard. I would also argue overall, my clients that have done group that was for a specific thing, like I'm thinking my LGBTQ plus clients, DBT skills, social skills, if it's a specific thing, they tend to have really good outcomes because they're exactly like Justin was saying, with people that can relate and understand them and all those things. I don't know, Justin, I know I'm pinging this to you, but you have the most group experience. Like any.
Yeah, I'm going to go into group sales mode real quick. Yeah. But I think it's important from our literature perspective to know that all the best data we have, that group is at least as effective as individual. What I know from being deep in the weeds of this is people think group is somehow some supplemental, not as good treatment. So it's like, I think it's great to talk about what the cons of group are, but I think because group is so well not known and people already think it's some supplemental thing and individual is better, I almost don't like diving into it. Because it's like, it's hard to get people to embrace that your external validity, meaning the way you're going to generalize the difficulty you're going through right now, is going to be far easier if you can do the distress tolerance and do it amongst your peers. People don't like that in our individualistic society where we think one-on-one is always better. It doesn't generalize as well to the real world. So we could talk all day long about group dynamics and this person, that person. It's valid, sure. But the idea that individual therapy is better, it generalizes better into real life, is completely false. So all the reasons we pitch in the positive, I would want you to get curious about. And the reason I pitch so hard that way is because I know people aren't thinking about group therapy. That's the rarity. People think individual therapy is the be-all, end-all. And the research shows it isn't, at least in the comparison.
I love that you brought that up, Justin, because I think, you know, yeah, people think it's supplemental or, you know, that they can't just do group. They need individual. For many people, group is actually more financially. Like, I hate that we're talking about, but we have to
live in the United States.
It's true. But like financially accessible. Or I think of it a lot of times as a good introduction to therapy. If somebody is not like ready to dive in one-on-one, I can gain skills. I can be with people that understand me, can relate to what I'm experiencing. Because group, I mean, individual therapy, we're all individual therapists here for the most part. Like, obviously there's benefits and it is an isolating and vulnerable process in many ways.
The spotlight's hot.
Like, you know, exactly. Absolutely. And not isolating and about, but like, it's all on you. Just like Justin, you were saying, like in individual therapy, our clients are staring at us. We're looking at our clients in group. Oh, let's look at Bobby. Oh, Anna's now talking, like, oh, and you can learn from other people, which you don't get in individual.
I think that's the key, because I ran a, I keep forgetting about this, the DBT facility. I was a DBT facilitator for like a while. And I noticed that the clients that I had in individual therapy with DBT, and then they would go to group, a lot of them would be like nervous and whatever. And for some people, group is not it right off the jump. Like, you need, like, like you were saying, need skills. And then once you get the skills, you're good, you know? So once clients would go into the group, I noticed they would get like overstimulated and they'd be like, there's so much going on. I can't remember everything. I'm like, you don't have to just go in and just experience it and take it all in. Because I think a lot of people, they'll go into their friend group or they'll go out in public or they'll be in a social setting. I'm putting it in air quotes, where they feel like they might be using their skills, but group therapy is a great opportunity to exercise it in a hopefully safe environment where people will help you and say, oh, I noticed you did that. Let me help you with this, or this is how I do it, or something like that. In the wild, in the grocery store, it's rare that somebody might actually help you with a distress tolerance skill if you're like, you know, just sitting there or standing there. So I do think that group is super helpful. I do get weary about it if people have a high tendency for, you know, suicidality and there's a lot of people talking about certain things. So in DBT group, we would always say like, we're not going to talk about certain topics in here, you know? So if it's facilitated in that way, I always feel really comfortable with my clients going in. It just depends on the client, obviously. I always like to bring that up.
So going back to family therapy, because I mean, that is a group therapy, just with your family. I think in my experience facilitating family therapy, the way it goes really depends on the motivation of all parties involved. Because, you know, there are circumstances where everybody's like, yeah, no, we want to come in. We want to like better our communication skills, things like that. And then there's like the times you feel, you know, like the sibling was just dragged in or like whatever is going on. But Justin, going back to something you were saying earlier about like the spotlight not being on you, I feel like when I'm doing family therapy, I do a lot less like talking and intervention and more like observing, reflecting.
Right.
And for me, and maybe this is, I just need more experience and get time. Like the session goes by so much faster because there's more people.
Right.
And we are at an hour, so we need to like wrap it up. But I think if people are willing to go, it's a safe space for you to share your perspective because you have a neutral third party there, mm-hmm. helping point out patterns that you wouldn't be able to pick up on otherwise. For me as a psychologist, it is helpful because the way I run it, like I've already said, is I have my client, but then we'll bring family in, and seeing real-time family dynamics is extremely helpful to the therapeutic process compared to just hearing my client's perspective, which is valid and legitimate and all those things. But when you actually see dynamics happening in real time and can like pause and be like, okay, what you said there, or this is where the rupture just mm-hmm. happened. Like, this is what was stated. This is how you interpreted it. Let's talk about those things. So I think it can definitely be a powerful tool. It can also be like, if we're talking about negatives too, like volatile. So I think it also has to be screened, just like you wouldn't do couples when there's domestic violence. Like, I fully believe you wouldn't do family therapy if there's abuse, unless it was, I guess, like retrospectively, when I used to work with foster kids and families, like when it got to a point, we would do family therapy with like the parent they were removed from, but it was a very like structured, and I don't know, not that regular family therapy isn't structured, but like the abuser had to do certain things before getting there.
Me just having the total realization that I'm really doing family therapy right now in my job. I was just sitting here and I was like, oh yeah, I do work with, no, it's a very different. I'm like, I do work with couples. I work on their parenting and their current situation. I don't work with them on their couple's dynamic.
Sure, sure, sure.
I work with like the two parents on the family dynamic and a lot of other things. But I was just sitting here. I was like, oh my God, how did I not put that to, because I don't think of it, because it's not considered, for my position specifically, it's not considered therapy. It's considered clinical support because I'm not diving into a lot of like specifically like with like the two parents. I'm not diving into their marital issues. I'm identifying if there is marital issues and being like, this is not related to this whole thing over here, but you should go see a counselor. Now that I'm sitting, I'm like, oh,
I'm doing it.
I'm kind of doing the thing.
Yeah, because you're seeing the bigger dynamic and the connection points and how everyone is interacting, relating, and whatever you call that.
And family therapy is just so interesting too, because the hardest part of that, one of the hardest parts that I think it is about family therapy is just like you said, the motivation of everybody involved and their willingness to hear feedback in those moments.
Oh, so it would burn sometimes.
Oh my God. So I have a friend who's currently in couples counseling, and she, I think my therapist was in the wrong for this. And she goes on and explains. And I was like, well, did you make it about you in the session? And she goes, well, yeah. And I go, so she wasn't wrong. And like, sometimes that's really hard to hear feedback in a session in front of your partner that says, hey, actually, you're in the wrong here. The decision that you made in this situation, the way you worded this, the way that you approached this wasn't helpful in the dynamic. Mm-hmm. And usually the point, like within couples therapy, is that everyone is being pointed and things are being called out and discussing how like those dynamics interchange with one another. But I think sometimes that is the hardest piece, because if one person is not willing to hear their role in the situation or being willing to admit, that also makes it really difficult, and can make it really sticky, because I have had, even in family therapies that wasn't specifically family therapy in my previous job, I've had parents storm out of the room because they did not like what I had to say or the dynamics that I pointed out and said, hey, that's actually not helpful in this. And I always try to say it like, you know, with grace and all of that. But if you're not ready to hear it, that can make it really hard too.
I always think, like, how do you know when you're ready to hear it? You know what I mean? Until you're in it. It's so, I just imagine it being so hard to hear that stuff, you know? Absolutely. And then if you have that level of like trust with the therapist, it could be an amazing experience for you to actually take something and say, okay, yeah, wow. Okay. I have to own some of this, you know, I have to own some of this. And if you're able to do that in a family therapy situation, I'd imagine it being really healing too, you know, to do it in real time. It's gotta be hard though. You know, I'd imagine it being like really vulnerable. Because there's multiple eyes. Like, it's not just you and the therapist. It's like your whole family's watching you, like, navigate this healing journey. It could be great, you know, but it could be vulnerable, I think. I've never done it, but I'm imagining, you know.
Yeah.
Well, and even as a therapist, stepping into that opportunity, that's a risky opportunity. Because, again, you could take a situation and have a person who really hears that. And they're like, oh, great. And it fulfills and it creates a different dialogue. Or it sets the whole room on fire.
That's I think whether it comes to family therapy or couples therapy, the thing I'd advise you is to be prepared to accept you are contributing to this. Yes. I'm telling you now, a lot of couples want to pull in the third person, this professional, and hope they're on your side. You are causing the problem. You're also at times the victim in certain circumstances. You're all the things. You're a part of the dynamic. And I'm warning you right now. And the couples I've worked with over the years, I love the relationships I've formed with them. And they'll tell me, they'll be like, yeah, I felt like you were extra harsh on me last session. I'm like, yeah, talk to me about that. Let's talk it out. But my job is always to facilitate the connection, the communication, and to point out how you're impacting the dynamic. And in any situation, you are impacting it. And so you might have stonewalled, you might have backed away, you might have not shared what you were feeling, whatever it might be. But I think that's the risky thing when you roll up to family or couples is if you think this ain't got nothing to do with me, it does. I'm warning you now, it does. It might be in a different flavor or form than like your dad or your other partner or whoever, but you're a part of the dynamic, so be prepared for the feedback.
I absolutely love that you brought that up, Justin, because that's honestly a lot what I talk about, especially my teens and their parents, is like there are two people or three, depending on if it's a two-parent household or two-guardian household, in this dynamic. So yes, even if, you know, your mother was really rude, your reaction is going to contribute to that dynamic. 100%. And yeah. And going back to your question, like K-10 of like, how are you ready to hear it? I don't think you know. And like, how are you even ready to know if you're ready for, that was a lot of readies, family or couples therapy? And I think that depends on the family. But like, I think I always go back to communication, whether it's within a family or in a couple, like, we could all benefit from communication skills. And if there is something within the dynamic that you feel is off or not serving you, that might be a sign. Like, and I think it's easier for couples. Like, most families don't go to family therapy just for funsies. There's usually like a rupture of some sort or a change of some sort. I feel like some couples do go to couples therapy if nothing is wrong necessarily. They just want to strengthen their relationship. But I think going back to Justin's point, it also comes down to like, what role am I playing in this? How can I learn? The feedback might be hard, but how can I learn? Or even I think, and I shared this on a separate episode, that my only experience in couples therapy is being in couples therapy with my husband. And even just like, I remember banging my head against the wall in this, but like something I have been trying to tell him for literal years, the therapist said, and he's like, oh, that makes so much sense. And I was like,
oh my goodness.
What? Like, I remember getting in the car and I'm like, I've been trying to say that to you for years. And he was like, but he just, because we got a male couples therapist, he was wonderful. And he was like, he just explained it in a way that like, makes sense. And I think about like, even in the moment, I was like, what the heck? But then moving forward, I was so grateful because I'm like, you know what? This is a reason. Like, we can have somebody explaining things in a different way and the dynamic, or explaining something maybe one partner's been trying to explain but didn't do it in the right way. And then it opens up communication.
And it's usually not personal. Like, it's not that you were explaining it the wrong way or something. It just like kind of hit, you know? And I think it happens in individual therapy too. Sometimes things just like kind of hit, you know? I have a couple of clients who are in couples simultaneously, and they'll say the same thing. Like, the couples therapist said it, and now all of a sudden, and I'm like, listen, I get it. You know, I understand valid feelings. And, you know, it's part of it. You know, it just might resonate differently, or just the way it's explained, like you're describing. So I think it could be such a, healing experience for people.
So I was reflecting back on when we were all talking about different levels of care. So KBI, you said you worked in residential. Justin, you did IOP. Me and K10 have done acute. Has anybody done PHP, partial hospitalization?
No.
But I think that might be good to talk about the different levels of care, because I think a lot of people, at least in my experience, when they think of like higher level of care, they think of acute hospitalization. Mm-hmm. They don't realize that there's those varying levels.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, not to put,
go ahead.
I was going to say, not to put Justin on the spot, but IOP is usually like the step up from traditional outpatient therapy.
I think that's a good way to think about it. It's funny because that's the one I refer to the most when people contact me in private practice. Meaning, it's sort of the thought, the way I explain it is it's the, you need more therapy than, you know, a once a week private practice therapist can give you, but you're not needing to sort of like stay in a place or have it be the majority of your day/days. Mm-hmm. So yeah, typically people go like to a place several times during the week for a few hours at a clip. It varies a lot of what it can look like, but you don't stay there. Maybe you go like on a Tuesday for some individual and on a Thursday for a group. And on a Friday, you meet with like sort of a case manager. But the variation is certainly there, but people are going multiple times a week in getting more treatment. Sometimes, mm-hmm. individual and group, sometimes individual multiple times a week. But most of us private practice, you know, therapists, at most see somebody once a week. And so you can kind of think of it's more than that. Several times a week, you know, a couple hours each time you drop in there, but usually not more than like 2 or 3 hours. That's how I would describe it. I'm not sure how y'all would.
Yeah. No, that's a beautiful description. I even think a lot of the people that I know who go, they still have their jobs for some, you know, they might still work. They might still do other things. You know, they don't have to, you know, stop their whole life for it. It could be in addition to, depending on like the hours and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which can be really helpful in accessibility.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've had a lot of clients do IOP for eating disorders. And yeah, since I work with teens, it's usually like from like 5 to 8 or 6 to 9 a couple times a week, so they can still go to school and do all those things. And it's like a mix of individual and group. And exactly like you said, Justin, it's that more intensive treatment. And how I tend to describe it is similar to you, Justin, like you need more than like the 1 hour of therapy a week, but you don't need partial hospitalization or residential, which we can talk about here shortly. But like you're getting more treatment in a shorter period of time so you can get better quicker and I mean, it's not like a 1-to-1 ratio. It's not like, but you know, if you're doing a 6-week IOP program, but you're doing 9 hours of therapy a week, and then you're getting a combination of individual, group, case management, some IOPs, depending on what they have, might have psychiatric, like all of that thing intensely. You're going to learn the skills. You're going to get closer with your therapist quicker because you're like seeing them connect with other people if there's a group aspect, and I don't know, just get quicker, better. Like I can't guarantee that, but like that's usually how I conceptualize it. And nobody has experience with partial hospitalization, right? Like, I don't either, other than like having clients go, but my understanding, and you all can correct me if you have a different understanding, is so partial hospitalization is like a step up from IOP. So it usually is like full day or majority of the day, like usually 5 to 8 hours per day, 5 days per week. So it's Monday through Friday, intensive therapy, and once again, individual, group, maybe case management, maybe rec therapy, but you're going home at night. But obviously, since it's Monday through Friday, most of the day, you can't necessarily go to school, work. I know for my teens that have done it, they do carve out some time during the day for schoolwork. I mean, not a lot, but to help them stay on track. But it's, yeah, that higher level of care compared to intensive outpatient. KBI, do you want to talk about residential? Not to put you on the spot, but I just did.
Yeah, residential is a whole other ball game when it comes to, you know, group dynamics, provider-client relationships, because a lot of times residential, those clients are living there. You know, every residential is different. All the residentials I worked in were long-term. The substance use one that I worked in was a 12-bed co-occurring men and women. The teen one that I worked in was 8 beds, and most of them had been there like a year or two. I worked in a transitional youth one. I worked on a crisis unit. That one tends to be like shorter. But there were people who were there for 30 days. But the difference is that you are working where these individuals are living. You know, you're getting experience in a lot of different ways. And I have a twofold. I have the experience just being like a residential service worker. I wasn't doing like therapy, but I was doing group work. I was doing bachelor's level work, as well as my internships were in these residential programs as well. You know, you get family therapy, you get that individual, but there's also just that group dynamic piece where I could be meeting individually one-on-one with someone. They're talking about their trauma. They're talking about all of that. Our session ends. They leave my office. I write up my case note. I go downstairs and they're playing Call of Duty. And I sit in the milieu with them. 10 minutes earlier, they were crying on my couch. And so that dynamic really shifts. And it's very for providers to be very aware of what that relationship will look like. Mm. I think it residential kind of like group therapy. Like Justin said, that peer-to-peer interaction plays a huge, huge piece.
Yeah.
Especially when individuals come in and they are new, and it shakes up the milieu a little bit. I mean, there have been multiple times where, you know, new clients would come in and they didn't really know the group dynamics, and peers put them in their place very quickly. But it also has that ability to be really, really healing and really, really connective, specifically like in the substance use home that I worked in. I don't struggle with substance use, but every single individual in that building who were clients did. And to connect in that way can be really helpful.
Yeah, I'm imagining residential is like a longer term experience compared to like acute, you know, inpatient. You know, because I worked on an inpatient secured level one crisis center for my practicum for a whole year. And even before that, I was like a mobile crisis counselor. Like I was just so embedded in crisis stuff. And what you're just describing, when like a new patient comes in and they're either actively detoxing or they're, you know, in active psychosis or something, it could shake up the unit, you know, and other people might be triggered or something like that. And it's always interesting to see that dynamic. But I think that's part of the process, you know, in terms of healing for people. And I always would try to coach people up like, this is a challenge. This is an experiment. You know, we got to experiment with our skills and all that stuff, because people will test us. When you get out of here, there's going to be people out in the wild who are going to test you in the same way, you know, maybe a little different way. But with residential, you have psychiatric medication management as well, right? Or do they go somewhere else for that?
It depends. It depends on the residential program. So most of the residential programs I worked with, they went outside, but like for the teen, all of the teens went to the same provider.
That makes sense.
They worked specifically with this medication manager because they knew she was good, and they basically would have back. They basically would show up in their blue van, actually their blue van, and everybody would have a back to back appointment, kind of do that and then come home. And it just depends, I think, on the residential program. There are definitely residential programs out there where a medication provider, a nurse, things like that are embedded in that program. But, you know, in a lot of these residentials, like things like your medications and things like that, like can be also very different. And I think it just depends on the type, whether you can manage them, someone else is managing them. Is it a free flowing residential? So like some of the residentials I was on, it was more locked down. Other residentials were more free flowing, but again, that's also a higher level of care as well. Mm-hmm. That's up there with like IOP. That's one step above IOP, but below hospitalization.
It's interesting to hear you say like the places you work didn't have medication management, because my experience with residential is either eating disorder residential, and once again, not me working there, but having clients, or like mental health for adolescents, mm-hmm. and like everything's there. Mm-hmm. Like medication management, dietitian, therapist, group therapist, everything in one setting. But yeah, I think of it as like longer term treatment. I mean, most eating disorder programs that are residential that I'm familiar with or have some clients who they say average like the stay is 6 to 8 weeks. But I've definitely had clients that stay 12 weeks. And then I know you just brought up acute in K-10, you brought up acute, where I think of acute more as, I mean, short term, because it's acute, like a week or so. And really that psychiatric crisis or emergency situation with all the same kind of key players in it. Like you have individual therapy, family therapy, or well, family therapy for kids, but group therapy, things like that.
Yeah. My experience in inpatient, I thought I was going to retire in an inpatient unit. I loved it so much. But I noticed it's basically, we get you stable to the point where you can function on your own and you're not an active crisis, or, you know, you're not a harm to yourself or others. And a lot of times people would actually come to our unit who were overflows from the ER because they just didn't have room. Mm-hmm. So we would, you know, have maybe 24-hour observation, or they'd be there for 72 hours, or they'd be there for like a week. I remember some people would be there for maybe 2 weeks, like max, you know? But then it's hard because then you get to know them, you know, and then they leave, and then it's like, okay, don't know where they went, you know? And I think that's why I switched to individual outpatient therapy, because I'm like, I just want that deeper connection. But I do think that the inpatient experience in terms of like the acute hospitalization, like really needing that crisis, could be really helpful for some people who really just need to kind of get back to a baseline where they feel comfortable at.
Yeah, I think of acute in any crisis situation as a state, you know, a state that you're trying to move someone out of, and then assessing once they're out of that state, what might be best for them.
Yeah.
And just to anybody listening, you know, this is really about meeting, especially if you meet with any sort of mental health professional and they're trying to, you know, assess what level is going to be best for you. You don't want a lower level than what you're needing based on symptoms.
Yeah.
And that's where I constantly remind people of like, you might really want to work with this one therapist who has a private practice and see them once a week. But if your symptoms are such that it's not going to be helpful or progress you, you don't want to be there. Like, our job as mental health professionals is to get you in the right space, like Jess and KBI were describing, where there's going to be the right amount of professionals, combination of treatments that you will get back to a baseline or learn new skills as quickly as possible. And working with a therapist once a week is not going to cut it for a lot of people. It doesn't match the severity and the symptoms and everything else. Or it just might take a lot longer, which is something to weigh out. But I think some people get a lot of judgment with these different levels. But the interesting thing is, there's almost no judgment if this was a physical issue. Like, meaning that if you're going through some sort of physical difficulty, you wouldn't be like, oh yeah, just toss it in a cast, even though I need surgery to like redo this bone. It's like, we don't question it when it comes to physical. But in mental health, we like, I think it's just the newness that mental health is, that people question a lot. But yeah, it's about having the right level of care.
Oh yeah,
Justin, I love that you. No, I was just going to say, I love that you brought up that comparison, because I was just thinking, like, as somebody that works in a hospital, and especially with physical traumas, if they're going to need some type of rehabilitation, we're like, okay, do you need inpatient rehab, or can you do this outpatient? But the first referral outpatient is very rarely, I'm not going to say never, one time a week PT. It's like, you're going to get PT and OT 3 times a week. like, and then you work your way down. But to your point, like just with like the stigma or judgment, people are like, wait, my therapist or somebody's recommending I do IOP. That's therapy 3 times a week. Like, okay, that's therapy 3 times a week. And what when I have seen the most success, and this is really in the eating disorder realm, is when people go to residential eating disorder treatment and then go through all the phases. So they go to residential and then they go to PHP and then they go to IOP and then they go to individual and like once a week with an outpatient team. And that's not a foolproof. I don't know why that was hard for me to say formula, but it does show like progress. And generally speaking, my client, and granted, that takes a lot of privilege and accessibility. I will say that. My clients that have done that are usually the ones that like are stable the longest because they got all the levels of care.
So true. I'm thinking back when I worked at that eating disorder clinic, and yeah, there's all those different levels, and I only worked there for like a little bit. But when my clients would go to like graduate to like IOP, it was like such a big celebration, you know, and everybody was like, yeah, you go. It was so nice to like see the support. And a lot of them were so nervous, like, okay. And then after that, I got to get a job. And then it's like one thing at a time, you know, you're only doing this for a couple of weeks. Like, you know, it's a couple of weeks out of your entire life. You know, it's not going to be forever. But I think selling it, like Justin was saying before, it's hard, you know, because I think when people think about, I have to take all this time, and what if I don't like the therapist? And what if I don't like the people? You might not like any of it, and that's okay. You know, you just have to kind of get through it and you might get better. Most of the time people do.
Yeah. I think the modality that is sort of popular has a cool topic to discuss. And maybe there's a Netflix documentary that shows the bad side of that we haven't talked about is wilderness therapy. What are y'all's thoughts on the old nature combined with some old therapy? KBI, we've decided this is an intervention and you're going to one.
Absolutely not.
You need it.
No, in a tent. The bus is out front.
It's a white van.
It's just picking you up. It's a white van.
It's got a bear painted on it. I painted the bear, so it kind of looks like just like a hybrid of a dog and a cow.
The idea of even sleeping a night in the woods sounds like a personal hell to me, so...
I want to go so bad.
This doesn't seem like this is going to be helpful. This seems like it will end up as a Netflix documentary.
Individual differences, but it regulates your sleep like no other.
Yeah, I have fine sleep.
We don't believe you, but...
My Aura sleep score will tell you otherwise. I'm pretty sure it was an 89 last night.
I have no idea what that means.
This is a conversation for another day. I don't have the bandwidth today.
Nice boundary.
That was a good boundary.
Have y'all ever heard feedback about wilderness? Like, what are your thoughts on it?
I don't think I know what it is. Like, I don't think I like know. I know the intention is like you go to, and correct me, you go to a place in the wilderness and you stay there. And then what? Like, I'm not joking. Like, so, and then what?
I mean, I can only speak from like, what it's like for teens
and
children, because adults, and I know they have like couples wilderness therapies and things like that. But I mean, you do traditional therapy. Like, so you have like individual therapy, group therapy in the wilderness. So it's therapeutic. There's medication management, things like that. But it also has like life skills built in, team building activities. For the teens, a lot of like, personal growth, social responsibility. I know, and the way I'm about to say this, I know people are probably going to have like strong reactions, but like with life skills, at least the wilderness therapy camps that I would do assessments at, like they would get 3 meals. I'm not like, and then they would have a snack bag and they had to learn how to like for the week, like this is the food for the week. So how do you like ration it? Do you share? Like, learning how to cook and like more like life skill things while out in the wilderness. And then like, it's also a level based. So when you first get there, it's the most intense in the sense of like one-on-one people watching you, things like that. And as you work up, you get more freedoms, you get to do like nature hikes and things like that. And we've talked on this podcast a bajillion times about the benefits of nature,
one of the places I was contracted with had equine therapy. So like there's a lot of different modalities, at least for adolescents, that you have the traditional therapy and also all these like life skills, communication skills, a lot of reflection, like a lot of journaling and writing letters to, you know, family, especially about what you've learned, maybe things you want to apologize for. Family therapy was part of it for teens as well. I don't know, Justin, you're nodding your head. You might have some more insights.
Yeah, I think just the other things, which I'm sure people get, is like exposure to nature is therapeutic. Does yeah. that mean that everybody loves nature, as we joked with KBI? No, but we do know across research that exposure to the outdoors, exposure to nature, exposure to that sunlight and exposure to darkness. Mm-hmm. And of course, you're moving a lot. A lot of these have like adventure courses and stuff. Yep. It offers you a lot of different sort of things that are good for you based on research that, mm-hmm. you know, you drive and see me at my office and my couch that's probably too old and my, you know, dusty. Like really, no, I'm kidding.
You're really selling it. You're really selling your private practice.
My
private
practice. You're like, yeah. Yo, I was gonna hit you up, but now your dusty, moldy office. I'm
old
like,
ass no. couch.
But in all seriousness, like there's limits to that. Like you sit on that couch, I talk to you for an hour, we work on things. I mean, yes, I'm a huge believer in it, but a lot of these other additions, like that nature and being at these sort of resort type places can offer, are great. I think the con is these things are like the wild, wild west, meaning there are some that are like incredible and people have great experiences, really healing, and they can be really pricey. And there's others that are like unethical.
Absolutely.
Like, they don't have professionals there. No offense to coaches, but there might just be people who call themselves coaches and they're just calling themselves this wilderness healing center. So they're not created equally and you have to do your research.
That's really good to bring up.
Oh, I was going to say, as somebody like, even though I was contracted and worked there for years and I won't share their stories, but I have family members that have gone to wilderness therapy and I still have mixed feelings. I had mixed feelings when I was contracted there. I was like removed because I was doing the psychological assessment aspect of it. But yeah, I mean, at least for teens, a lot of times they're the kids that have behavior problems. And so, you know, you risk runaways. You do hear the stories about kids, and I'm focused on kids, but there's other ones, you know, that die because of,
yeah,
cold weather or other things, unethical things. But then there's, like Justin said, really, really good ones that are really healing. Or even like you were talking about adventure camps, like rope skills courses. Like that is a way you're still learning like communication skills because you're working with a partner, things like that. And yeah, if you get the good ones, they do have good outcomes, but the bad ones have really bad outcomes too, or can have. And to Justin's point, they are extremely expensive. Like I was definitely working with a very specific demographic. Wow. They are not affordable. Side story that is related. When we did intake paperwork, it would be like, who referred you? And I saw one that said Dr. Phil. And I was like, that was weird. Why did they say that? But like Dr. Phil like has a hand in a lot of the wilderness therapy camps and will like pay for teens to go. So like it was actually Dr. Phil that referred.
He literally said, catch me outside. Like for real.
No, literally.
Wow. Wow.
But yeah, they are very expensive, which you would think you're in the wilderness in a cabin or a tent. but they are extremely pricey.
I'm thinking of like all the ranges, because I know we're talking about like different levels of stuff. I wasn't sure if it was like, I guess I'm thinking of like, okay, walk and talk therapy with your individual therapist around. Like that's one way to get outside. And then another way is like outpatient therapy in outside, outdoors, you know, group therapy somewhere. And then I'm thinking of wilderness therapy and how that's like, you're really out there, you know, like you're just,
you're there,
you're in it, you're committed. Like, you know what I mean? Like you have to commit to that. And that might not be for everybody. And like you guys said, I mean, there's a lot of like accessibility concerns and ethical concerns potentially. Good to keep in mind.
So we've talked a lot about different modalities. I just wanted to like pose this last question before we transition. We talked about family, group, couples, higher levels of care. What would you all recommend? Or like, how, if somebody's like, how do I know if I should seek out one of these things? What would you say to them? And you can choose whatever modality you want, because I know they're all different.
When I think of like IOP and stuff like that, or a higher level of care, I think that's comes with some level of like, it's clinically indicated for some reason, right? Like potentially maybe you're an individual and like we were talking about, like you might need more help, you might need more care, you might need more support. But when it comes to group therapy, I think that there are really like just a handful of reasons why group therapy wouldn't be helpful for someone. It really depends on like what you're looking for. But I always say, give it a try, you know, do an experiment. If you don't like it, you don't have to go back. But I think it really, really helps if you, especially I work with a lot of people with anxiety, social anxiety, phobias, stuff like that. And I think it's really helpful to get around other people experiencing something similar so you don't feel so alone. So I usually recommend it if my clients are like, do you know anybody else who experiences this? Or they'll say things like, I feel like really alone right now in this, or nobody in my social circle gets it. When I hear those things, I think, wow, group would be great. Again, depends on the person and what they want to do. And in private practice, I guess that's what I'm limited to right now. But what about y'all?
I think it's just staying open. Like, I think that's the problem. And I fought this for years doing group coordination of like, I think we just have a heavy bias towards individual. But I hope this episode, I hope in thinking about different modalities have different strengths. And people know of individual, people don't know of these others. And I'm sure, yeah, people have heard of couples and family and stuff. But yeah, if you can meet with a mental health professional and get their recommendations, exactly what K10's saying, I would take them seriously. Because they're trying their best to get you connected in the best way. But I also love when people dive into the research, look up a wilderness camp, like look into different groups in your area. Like, I think that goes a long way because you start to see potential and options. And I know I always say it, but you stay curious, because I think unfortunately our field has been locked for too long of this one-on-one individual therapy, which is great, but it might not be the best fit for what you're going through.
Mm-hmm. No, it is always a great fit.
Always.
Research. The Google Scholar Shorts. Does anybody want to guess what modality I chose to do an article on? I did, yeah.
What?
Because, I mean, I figured like that would be the one that people don't know as much about. So kind of leaping off of our discussion, the question I'm going to pose to you all is, what factors do you believe play a role in which adolescents improve and which adolescents decline in wilderness therapy? Why are you covering your mouth and laughing? Oh, I thought you were laughing.
No, because all I wanted to say is if it's abusive or not.
I was thinking that, but like I don't want to say it out loud.
I mean,
talking about like individual factors, but yes, I would assume that if it's abusive,
they decline.
Their willingness.
Yeah, like I'm thinking like openness to experience, maybe, or like,
do they like the outdoors? Because that would not be the place I go.
Thinks if it's working well, self confidence, sort of confidence, self esteem. Like you said, Jess, a lot of times you learn new skills and new abilities in a new environment. So self-esteem, adaptability, those are things that jump into my mind.
So this study looked at 5,639 adolescents attending wilderness therapy programs. And then the authors examined individual and familial factors that predicted membership either in the top 10% of adolescents in with regard to like mental health improvement. So the top 10% that improved the most and compared to the bottom 10%. So the ones that basically got worse from pre to post program. So there were significant effects of adoption, parental effort, presenting issue, and family functioning. And I'll get into that. So adopted adolescents were 2.95 times more likely to be in the deteriorators group rather than the most improved group compared to non-adopted adolescents. I have my thoughts on that, but I would love to get y'all's thoughts after. Compared to adolescents whose parents' efforts were rated as exceptional, adolescents whose parents' effort was anything other than exceptional were anywhere from 4.8 to 8.2 times more likely to be in the deteriorators group rather than the improved group. Adolescents whose primary reason for the program referral was autism spectrum disorder or other neurodevelopmental disorders were 2.95 times more likely to be in the deteriorators group compared to adolescents whose primary reason for referral was mood disorder. And then another significant predictor of deterioration was family functioning. More specifically, for every one unit increase on the measure of family dysfunction, the odds of being in the deteriorator group increased by a factor of 15.6. So the more family dysfunction, the worse the child did. And then among adolescents who most improved during wilderness therapy programs, those whose parents' personal effort was rated exceptional by staff were 8.22 times more likely to be in the most improved group. And this was a random one that I wanted to add in because I feel like, I don't know, this just seemed super random to me, but you know, results. Another factor that predicted those that were most improved was identifying as pansexual. So adolescents who identified as pansexual were 10.36 times more likely to be in the most improved group compared to heterosexual adolescents. No? So really the findings provide a lot of information for like healthcare providers or families who are looking into wilderness therapy programs. Because for example, if you have an adopted child or a neurodivergent child, wilderness therapy may not be the best outcome for them. Or if the family is not willing to put in the effort, wilderness therapy may not be the best. But if you have a pansexual adolescent with a mood disorder and a highly supportive family may have really strong outcomes. That's what I thought. But I was like, but like, that is a significant statistic.
It is.
That is huge.
Justin, your thoughts?
Well, I was just going to say with the pansexual, I wonder how pansexual like correlates with general openness.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was thinking.
I mean, like, I think that's a positive correlation. Mm-hmm. Every pansexual person I've ever known, and again, it's individual differences, but I'm like, I wonder if it's just more open. I think you're just more open to experience that. And you're just there and you're soaking in it. Because I'm fascinated that when a statistic is that highly predictable, it's not a coincidence. There's something here. Fascinating.
Right. Yeah. Now that I think, everybody that I've met who's pansexual has been so open to experience and so like curious. You know what I mean? Like I'm trying to think of words to describe them. Really curious and wanting to learn and wanting to soak things in. You know what I mean? Wow.
Yeah. Do you all have any thoughts on the adoption aspect and why they might do worse?
I got all the thoughts.
I mean, you want to share any of them?
No.
Okay. Moving on.
As someone who works, you know, in foster care right now, I mean, to leave and go somewhere else yet again.
Yeah.
Even if they know that it's temporary, like it's I'm being uprooted from what I know yet again. There is a lot to, I mean, I think that there's also a lot of self-esteem, self-worth, the way that they view the world that impacts that as well. My parents are sending me away. They don't love me. And I think that that comes from an even deeper place from adoption. And that's me making assumptions based off of just knowledge of working in the system. That statistic doesn't surprise me. The autism and neurodivergence doesn't surprise me. I'm thinking of sticking, I'm thinking if I would ever stick Oliver in the middle of the woods, he wouldn't have access to hockey. Kid wouldn't be, kid wouldn't be having a good time. Like,
he'd be like, give me some stats right now.
Right now.
But like, thinking of like specifically autism and how rigid that they could get in routine.
Right.
And again, depending on where they are at in their levels, like what does their communication look like? What does their understanding of a situation?
I think of sensory issues as well.
That's what I was thinking.
100%. And being out in the wilderness, like there's no control over noise, bugs, textures.
Can you imagine going to wilderness therapy while all the cicadas are screaming for 6 weeks? Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that?
See, even for me, that's like
I would be in the my deterioration would be like 78%.
Give me that blowtorch.
I feel like out of the four of us, KBI would definitely be in the bottom 10. Justin would definitely be in the top 10, and K10 and I would be somewhere in the middle.
Depends on my mood.
With the parenting thing though, I also think that makes perfect sense. Cause like, just imagine like you don't feel like you have like good or adequate parents. Like you're in this wilderness knowing where you have to go back to.
Yeah.
It's about having a secure base. And it's like you could really soak up a lot of positive experience knowing you have a secure base to go back to and that you're, you know, there's no perfect parent, but you're supported. But think of the opposite where you're like counting down the weeks that you have to go back to parents that, again, are rated as poor or under. Yeah. Like it just feels like, yeah, that wilderness therapy is probably not going to do much.
Well, and even I think like, a lot like... I was going to say, working in residential, like, the fix my kid.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say.
Right.
Because
that was a lot.
Because usually, at least in my experience, wilderness therapy is like, we've tried all these other things. Or we've tried a lot of things. And so parents might just be like, send my kid off for weeks at a time. And... yeah, if they're not involved, like...
it's got to be so hard.
Or, like, I know, like, our kids wrote a lot of letters to their parents. And, like, imagine sitting next to, like, Susie, who's getting letters weekly from her parents, and you're not. Like, I don't know.
Wow.
Well,
I don't know if I'd make it, guys. I don't know if I'd make it, you know? I don't know.
You'd be in the bottom 11 or bottom 10.
I think it depends on my mood. I don't know. Sometimes I'm like, yeah, I just need a break. I like the wilderness. And then when I really don't want to break and they're like, and somebody would say, oh yeah, you got to go. I'd be like, no, I don't want to go. You know what I mean? So imagining like a younger,
right now,
I imagine a younger version of me would probably be like, oh my God, this is what? But
so quickly, how long do you think you'd make it? Like I could do 2 months easy. Send me away for 8 weeks. Let's go.
I think it depends. So I think for me, I have such a strong connection to the people in my life that if I wasn't able to contact them or something, I guess, let me reframe. I'd probably have to do a lot of distress. I could do it. I think it would be challenging for me personally. I could probably make it like a couple weeks. Without like cell service, like all that stuff. Like I'm cool with not being on my phone, but like not seeing my friends or my people. That's hard for me.
Now, are we talking like we got what we need? Are we talking like naked and afraid, but we still have clothes?
No, listen.
You have clothes.
And you probably have
KBI is thinking this is something that
our kids didn't have cell phones, but they could call their parents if they were at a base camp.
I could actually probably do it for a while. Honestly, like
a few weeks.
Yeah, I could do a few weeks. I wouldn't be happy about it. I would absolutely do a few weeks.
You could do
weeks.
It mad. You could do it, man. It's fine.
Yeah, I could do it out of spite. Like,
see, you got to fuel it. I think you got to find a reason, you know, and then just latch onto that.
I mean, honestly, that maybe sounds like a vacation from motherhood right now. Like, let's go.
I mean,
no more hockey facts.
No more.
We're going to the polls. I'm cutting this off.
I was about to say, no more facts. We do like the facts of the polls.
The poll. Me too.
All right. So the first poll was, have you ever went to couples therapy, family group, or I've been to multiple types of therapy? Which one do you think our group members rated the highest? What am I trying to say?
Most of them went to.
Go ahead. Couples, family,
group. Family. I don't think couples because of just like the age and demographic.
I think group.
Group, yeah.
Group therapy was the highest.
Let's go.
I know. I was so excited. And then multiple types of therapy was below that. And that wasn't the best question because we don't know what types they've been to. The next one was, if you want to go to group, couples, or family therapy but haven't yet, what is holding you back? Mm-hmm. And we got a lot of really good questions or really good responses here. Somebody said, I don't really know, to be honest. I haven't thought about it. Finding the time, my schedule is really chaotic. I struggle to talk about my issues with so many people. I could barely talk to one-on-one or to friends. I feel like it would be hard for me. Fear of judgment and embarrassment, costs, insurance, social anxiety. Somebody said I despise people. Okay, respect it. Finding the right group. I really don't know how to find the right group. My family doesn't want me to go. A lot of people put money. Like, I think the cost was like the biggest barrier for people. And then the last question was, what do you love about couples group or any other type of therapy? So I said, tell me what you love. I wanted to end on a positive note. Support and vulnerability from other group members was so incredibly validating. I felt so seen. I was like crying when I read these earlier. It was really, really sweet. Feeling that I'm not alone in my experiences. I like group because I'm surrounded by people who have similar struggles, support and understanding, objective third parties. Those facilitators will put you in your place. LOL. Love it. All right. Yeah. Feeling less alone. A lot of it was like community, kinship, togetherness, connection. A lot of people talked about group. I did not see a lot about couples. At all. I found one on couples. Couples therapy has helped our communication tremendously. So that was a good one. But yeah, those were the polls.
You know what I love about group therapy? What? You guys.
I knew it. I knew it.
You were going to say something cliche.
She hits us with the cheese.
It's like random though. She's like so mean to us. And then she'll say one thing and I'm like, oh, she reeled me back in. All right, we're good. It's like intermittent love.
Yeah, that variable reinforcement, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It works, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah.
I'm still here. Yeah.
You know what we always love? The group member questions. So we got some really good ones. I'm excited. And hopefully some of y'all's questions that we're not going to get to are answered in our discussion. But I loved this one from Katie from Boulder, Colorado. She asks, what are the ethics around one partner's individual therapist then becoming the couple's therapist while still treating that partner? My spouse and I are trying to find a couple's therapist, but both really love our individual therapists and are struggling to find one that fits us both. Just in your face.
I feel whatever he's feeling.
I hate this. Here's the thing. I know therapists do this. I absolutely despise it. It just, it.
Yep.
You're always gonna be biased. I don't give a fuck what that therapist or mental health professional says. They are biased to the original narrative in the original client. Don't do it. And I know there's a therapist driving right now. It's like, chill out, Justin. I do this. Do I think it's necessarily the end of the world? No. But do I think that you're far better getting someone who has not worked with either one of you? Yes.
I very strongly agree. I know Justin and I don't always see eye to eye on every single thing. Yes. But I really agree with you on this 100%, just from an ethical standpoint. And then I also think as a therapist, you have to do so much more work to remain objective if you're in that situation. Why would you want to put yourself there?
Yeah.
Just refer out. Make your job easier. Make your life easier. Make it easier for everybody. You know, I know it feels easy and accessible to say, oh, I could just do this. You should think about it. I really think about the consequences potentially. I know that for some people, if they live in rural towns, I'm thinking of like remote areas. I know it's not always possible. I get that. And I understand that and valid. Right. If there's an option, think about the option, you know, I just think about ethics and I really just think a lot of people do their clients a disservice. I don't think they do it intentionally. I think people are trying to help. But I've only seen it really shake out in good ways if you're in a really remote area and there's like literally no other therapists around.
Yeah.
That's a really strong opinion. Yeah. Okay.
No, I have the same feeling. The dual relationship aspect. Like Justin said, you can't remain objective. And then like, I don't know. I don't know. What is then going on in the individual session? Is that just a carryover from the couples session? What happens if, you know, cause like some people go to couples therapy to, you know, enhance their relationships. Some people go to couples therapy and realize like a separation is like, and then what does it look like with the certain outcome? I don't know. I just feel like it could get messy.
It just gets a little messy. Yeah,
disrupt the rapport, the original partner. And that therapist had.
Then I think too, like just say you're an individual therapist providing individual therapy to your client. And then you decide to do couples therapy with that client and then their partner. Who's to say that that client, that original client that you have what if they want to process the group therapy or the couples therapy session in your individual session? That puts the other partner at a huge disadvantage. They don't have that space to process. And then they might feel like an outsider or othered. I mean, there's just so many dynamics that I think that you might not have control over as a therapist in that situation, that I just wouldn't feel comfortable doing that.
So Maggie from New York asks, my therapist recommended trying group therapy or a support group where I'd meet other people who share my diagnosis. All of the ones I've found are online. What are your thoughts of in-person versus telehealth group therapy? Are there any differences between in-person telehealth? Justin,
I've ran. Okay. Oh, okay. Were you going to answer?
No, I thought Justin was about to talk and he was muted.
Oh, shit. Justin, were you? I'm always stepping on your toes. Okay. I'm just going to own it. And I'm going to go. So I ran a CBTI group, healing and growth. I ran a CBTI group online. It went really well, but CBTI is really structured through telehealth. You know, we have your sleep diaries and all that stuff. I've never ran a group like a DBT group or like a support group through telehealth. I do know that there's research to support at least individual therapy, telehealth versus in person. There are still benefits. It's just based on patient preference, but I don't really know of any of the negatives or benefits of group online. Do you guys know?
I think it's pretty equivalent to the data that exists on individual, meaning it's still beneficial. If you're asking for like a nuanced perspective from me, having done a lot of in-person and doing some online groups, it's just like you would think, like if all your friends, and it's not saying this is friends, you know, it's therapy, but if all your friends met up and were chatting over, you know, Zoom or on a Discord or whatever, versus you're all in the same room, what are some of the things you notice? So the things you notice is sometimes people, like we do on this podcast, we talk over each other. I edit a lot of that out because you don't hear it, but you talk over each other. It's harder to read cues online. There's also delay in sort of delivery. A lot of it, it's just tech, and a lot of it is convenience. So back to what we already know. So if it's more psychoed, I think you're going to notice less of that. If it's more support and sharing, you're going to notice what you already think. Meaning sometimes people are going to talk over each other and you just experience less of that in person because there's more reading the room behavioral cues that are easier in person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. I would say my teens that have done like virtual, like IOP, for example, because my state doesn't, and my IOP experience is really with eating disorders, like I said, doesn't have an option here. They'll talk about how like it might be like awkward at first, like because you're not actually getting to be in the room, but still get the benefit. And Maggie, I know you asked about like in-person versus telehealth. This is not necessarily the answer to your question, but I would argue that if the only groups you can find are online, an online group is better than no group, especially if your therapist is recommending it. And that community support. Okay. So M from New Mexico has a two-part question about family therapy. First, how can I make family therapy more appealing to family members that are hesitant when it comes to anything mental health related? And then if my family and I were able to actually try family therapy, how can I navigate therapy with them in an honest way without harming our relationship outside of the therapy office?
I don't have any experience with family. I'm just going to take a stab at it. I would imagine that if people aren't willing to go, then it's going to be hard, you know, to keep people engaged. And I don't know what that might be like to get people more involved or to create a more appealing, to make it more appealing. But I do wonder if you have conversation. I'm just thinking of a friend that I have who's in family therapy right now and actually experienced the same thing. And she said, hey, let's just try it. And if we don't like it, we could always like not do it. You know, let's just try it and just see what happens. Let's just kind of do a new thing together as a family and just see what happens, you know? And I think that kind of creating a little bit of curiosity might be helpful. I think it depends on the family though. Again, I have no experience with family therapy, but I do wonder if there's like a way to like open it up for people.
Yeah. I would kind of going off what you said is maybe talk about your goals. Because I would argue yes, therapy is mental health related, but family therapy is much more about the interaction and dynamics. And so if you could like share about your goal, it's not be like
necessarily because this person has X diagnosis and that's why we need to go. If it's more, hey, like, I really want us to work on our communication in a place that we can all be heard and validated or get an outsider's perspective and take it less off of like, I think you talk to me this way or things like that. I don't imagine that's how you're approaching it. And then with regard to like how to navigate therapy with them in an honest way without harming your relationship, I wish I could guarantee there would be no harm done, but that's why it's the beneficial to have that therapist there to mediate. And as we already talked about, like feelings may be hurt. You may not be open to feedback. One thing, you know, I encourage anybody to do is be honest about their feelings first with what they're going to say. So like, you know, I really want to be honest with you. I'm really scared of how you're going to respond. And you can process that with the therapist before saying the thing that you're worried about.
I like that.
Okay. So K10, you kind of brought this up. So Chris K, which when I saw that, I thought of Chris Kardashian, from Alberta, Canada. I don't think Chris Kardashian is from Alberta, Canada. No. Is there even a point to couples or family therapy if your partner or parent needs individual therapy but refuses to go?
I think it can be hard. I think, you know, there can still be benefits of going. Absolutely. But I think that a lot of times you're going to keep hitting those walls or the barriers or whatever it may be that needs to be addressed in that one-on-one. It's not that it would be completely unsuccessful, but maybe it's something that then pushes them into individual. Sometimes that does happen. Kind of like Jess, like you said in your couple therapy, like, I've been saying this, and then it's done. Sometimes maybe it's that therapist saying, hey, you need individual. And they're like, oh yeah, that sounds like a great idea. You know, that's the perfect world, but you know, that's what makes it hard.
I totally agree. Yeah, I think it'd be good to come in with sort of low expectations, but exactly what KBI said, I think is the possibility, which is why a lot of couples will try. They'll be like, I've been begging my partner to get individual therapy for a long time. We're going to go as a unit, kind of warm them up to what therapy can look like, how, you know, get them in front of a professional, see it's not scary, you know, gain them the experience, if you will. But I think a lot of people try that as like sort of a Hail Mary to see. And yes, some people have pivoted from there into getting their own treatment, but it's a long road. Like KBI said, that's not a short road if they're already resistant to. But, you know, it's your time and it's your money and it's your energy. So you weigh that out of the potential that it could lead to some change. Maybe it's worth it.
So I think we have time for one more question. So this question comes from Cass from Kansas. How much are you supposed to share in group therapy? Is it more surface level, or do people really share about their traumas, bad coping mechanisms, etc.? I would love to know what the expectation and etiquette is. I thought this was a great question.
I think it varies from group to group. And usually at the beginning, when a group is established, those ground rules are usually set. You know, when I ran a DBT skills group, you know, we didn't talk in depth about our traumas or things like that because it was a skill-based group versus if it was a DBT therapy group, that might look a little different. And it also might look different sometimes. Like, yes, we want you to talk about things, but we also need to be aware that we are in a room full of other people as well. And you know, what that might look like. And I think that's, you know, the nice thing about group therapy is you usually create those expectations and things at the beginning when the group is established.
Beautifully said. Yeah. And I think it depends on the amount of people who are in the group too. You know, if you have like an allotted hour and there's only four of you, five of you, there might be more room or more time to get more in depth depending on the ground rules. But when I was doing a DBT skills group too, it's It's so funny because people have this inclination. They're like, I want to say more about it. I want to say more about what I did this week, you know, or what I'm struggling with. And we just can't go there all the time, you know, because then it turns into a process group and not a skills group. So I think like KPI is saying, really depending on the goals of the group too, that's really important. If it's a support group, that's a little different. I ran a bunch of support groups, LGBTQ support groups, trans support groups and stuff like that. And there's a little more room to go in more depth because it's more of like a process support space, depending on what you're experiencing. But if it's a skills-based group, I always err on the side of it's let's learn some skills. Let's talk a little about our personal experience and keep it moving, depending on the facilitator and the groups, the group rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. And I was just going to say, K10, I appreciate that you brought up like a support group versus like a skills group, because sometimes support groups are ran by therapists. Other times they're not. Skills-based groups are usually obviously ran by a licensed professional or someone in training. But yeah, I completely agree with everything both of y'all said. It really depends on the group and the purpose. And KBI, you know, you highlighting like the expectations should be set out at the beginning of the group.
Well, I expect another excellent Welcome to Group Therapy pod coming out next week. And we're stoked y'all are always here with us along this journey. Learn a little bit about IOP, PHP, residential, a little bit of couples, group, whatever you took away from the wild wilderness that is mental health. Thanks for being on this journey with us. Share this with someone. Give us a little review, a little rating. Drop us a little comment. We love your feedback, but we're always grateful you're here with us in the Welcome to Group Therapy pod. We'll see y'all next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye. Bye.